This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Looking at the influence of money in politics today, there's a scandal brewing involving Governor McCrory and top legislators of both parties, though there is now a question as to whether the allegations will be investigated. The State Elections Board was just beginning to investigate more than $200,000 of allegedly illicit political donations, but then their term expired and Governor McCrory made the unusual move of replacing all of them. Bob Hall is here today. He's director of Democracy North Carolina, a nonprofit that looks at the role of money in state politics. Democracy North Carolina filed the original request for an investigation into these findings. Bob Hall, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So tell us about this $235,000 in political donations tied to an Oklahoma sweepstakes operator. What's the story here?
Well, he has this outfit. He supplies the software to the sweepstakes cafes, which are the latest incarnation of video poker. And he has the guts of the machines. He got busted in Florida in a scandal that involved $300 million in illegal gambling. They were using a veterans charity as a front to lure people into the cafes around the state, saying you can win a prize and other money will help this charity. Actually, hardly any money helped the charity.
And I'm going to stop you right there because I think he's been arrested for that.
Yeah.
Right? But that trial is not over. So those are still allegations
at
the moment?
Yeah, that's right.
Those are still allegations.
Allegations.
The allegations is that he set up this front to help homeless veterans funnel the money into a business and kept it for himself.
Right. A whole network of folks, 57 people busted.
Got it.
And there's political money flowing in Florida big time. The lieutenant governor has resigned in Florida in relation to this scandal. Here in North Carolina, he put about $230,000, $40,000 into political campaigns in 2012. He's the biggest single donor to General Assembly campaigns. So, and it turns out the way the candidates reported the money, all kinds of different ways. They said he was a lawyer with the Moore & Van Allen firm, which is a lawyer firm, which actually Pat McCrory, our governor, worked with right up through the election. So that's how he gets sort of implicated, because he got the money and he also is involved in the lobby firm. The lobbyist from Moore & Van Allen, they admit that they actually delivered a number of these checks from this man. His name is Chase Burns. So Chase Burns is in Oklahoma, but his money's here in North Carolina getting delivered by lobbyists from the firm of Pat McCrory.
But not under and not under his name. I mean, that's the thing. It all of a sudden gets, in effect, laundered because now it's coming from this lobby firm and not from him or
from him. His names are on the check. Yeah. But the way the candidates report it, they associate him with the firm. They call him an attorney with Moore & Van Allen, or they give the address of the Moore & Van Allen's office in Cary, or you know, they say he's a public relations official. And then they include the name of the lobbyist for Moore & Van Allen.
So wait a minute. There's disclosure documents. It's got his name on it. He's a sweepstakes operator and a software maker. He's in Oklahoma. But Moore & Van Allen says, oh, no, he's an attorney with us, or at least according to this document, he's listed as an attorney with them.
It turns out what happened apparently is that the lobbyist delivered these checks in envelopes with the business card of the lobbyist with the check from Chase Burns. So, you know, the candidates or the treasurer, they would put it in – they would get it all mixed up. And that kind of set off some red flags immediately. And it turns out that he's – you know, there's another whole set of money that comes from his colleagues, other sweepstakes operators in North Carolina and South Carolina, giving directly to McCrory. There's another lobby firm involved in that group of checks. So the whole thing is looking like it stinks. You know, looks like he's using business money, which would be illegal in North Carolina. A number of the checks that Chase Burns gave to candidates had different handwriting in the payee line. So this is sort of shades of Jim Black, remember, where there were blank checks that he could fill in.
Jim Black, Democratic House Speaker, who eventually went to jail for his. Yes.
Yeah. So we have this. This guy wrote over 60 checks, like I say, over $200,000, and many different handwriting. So who else is involved in making these? Is the lobby firm involved in making the donor? We're asking these questions. We want to get to the bottom of it. There looks like also bundling, perhaps, on the other set. You've got a bunch of sweepstakes operators who apparently gave money to one of their kind who then gave it to the lobby firm. That would be illegal for
the lobby.
What do
you mean bundling? How does that work?
Well, if each of us, you know, five people give one check and the sixth person takes it and gives it to the candidate, that's a bundle of checks. But if that sixth person is a lobbyist, that would be illegal in our state because the lobbyists are not supposed to be involved in the transaction of multiple checks. They're not, you know, they're supposed to actually be involved in giving you information, right? They're helping you figure out what a problem is as a lobbyist, not financing your campaign.
So one thing is if Chase Burns was using corporate money, his corporation's money, and giving that as a campaign contribution, that would be illegal, and there's fairly good evidence of that. We don't know for sure, but it's not been investigated. The other is whether or not lobbyists then are acting as aggregators for these individual campaigns. That would be illegal. And then there's the question of transparency. If he doesn't show up, if Chase Burns doesn't show up as a representative of a sweepstakes gambling interest, I don't know that my lawmaker received money from a guy who got an interest in gambling, right?
Right, right. And he may not have been the one who actually designated the checks, where the checks go. If those are payee lines are blank, somebody, it's sort of like he turned over a bag of cash to somebody that had $200,000 in it, you know, $1,000 bills in there, and somebody else distributed them. He's financing the whole operation, but somebody else is involved in this operation.
And then how would he benefit by that? Then it would be the lobbyist who would then act in his behalf.
Exactly. And they were very clear what they wanted. They wanted to legalize this industry. The sweepstakes industry has been taken to court. The state Supreme Court has upheld that it's illegal the way they were running the games. And it's cash payout now. It's hundreds of millions of dollars in money.
And in fact, an affidavit in Florida where Chase has already been arrested and charged with racketeering shows that nearly $100 million in gambling proceeds came from North Carolina.
In that particular investigation, right? They were focusing on Florida operations,
right.
But the bank accounts were just flooding with North Carolina money as well. He's got a half a dozen different bank accounts. And that affidavit says that he uses these accounts to basically launder money, hide it, and so it's quite a scheme that he's developed.
Well, we will take a look at whether that scheme is going to be investigated here in North Carolina or whether the investigation will be dropped. That conversation continues in a moment, so do stay with us on the State of Things with Bob Hall, Director of Democracy North Carolina. State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about money and politics. We're talking about possible campaign donation violations with Bob Hall, Director of Democracy North Carolina, which is a nonprofit that looks at the role of money in state politics. So we talked about Chase and his Chase Burns and the money that he has spent in North Carolina. Who got that money? Where did it go?
Well, he sprayed it all over. He hit the top folks with the most. McCrory got $8,000 between Mr. and Mrs. Burns. And then the leadership, Tom Tillis, the speaker, he got the second most, and the president pro tem, Phil Berger. So $8,000, $6,500. Then there were about 20 or 30 of the second tier who got $4,000 a pop. And then another 20, 30 got $2,500 by. And then another.
Wow.
He really did spread it around.
Covered all his bets, I guess you'd say.
You got that right. And Democrats as well as Republicans.
Democrats and Republicans. So
yeah,
that's
Republicans are in power now, so it's heavily tilted to the Republicans.
So how does this work? What's the culpability or the suggested culpability? Do we think McCrory knew? Did Tillis and Berger know?
Well, I think a lot of people do wonder how McCrory, if he was working in the lobby firm, the law firm at the time, all this time, that's going to be a question I think people want to know. And he had clients, you know, or were these folks his clients, or did he meet with them? He now says that he first said he didn't meet with the sweepstakes people. Now he says he met with both sides. So I think there will be some questions about who did he meet with, when did he meet with, what are the circumstances that he met them, who were in his law firm, you know, just a whole thing around that. A lot of the legislators, no doubt, were not aware of who this man was. They knew the lobbyist, involved. But, you know, it is, people have to believe that when they get checks, especially large checks, they might wind up in the newspaper associated with that donor. So they do need to be aware that who this donor is. They ought to do a little bit more digging. I'm not saying that they should turn away money that comes in. Our organization basically says people have to play by the rules as they are. We want leaders to change the rules. The whole system is what stinks here. All these legislators are so desperate for cash to run their campaigns. It's a competitive operation, and where do they get the money from? They got to get it from private sources because there's not a public source like public radio. You know, they're not doing these fundraisers.
Give us a call, 1-800-962.
Exactly.
Call now.
I mean, you know, imagine if they were getting 60, 70, 80% of their money from a public source, from us, the voters, instead of 100% of it from somebody who's got their hand on their shoulder saying, "Now I helped you, now it's your turn to help me."
We are proud to say 60% of our funding comes from individual donors like you. So I thought I would get that in there. But yeah, you're right. That's a question. Somebody's signing a check for you. You're beholden to them, so you need to know who
it is.
We've
got a judicial program now that's on the chopping block. The one public financing program that we have that's working is for our top judges. They don't have to raise private money. They can get a lot of small donations from voters, and then they get a public grant. And the folks in the General Assembly, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, want to kill it. So, you know.
That's a system that you would like to see applied
absolutely,
way across.
We need to defend that one.
What about this investigation now? We have a whole new elections board. The old board had just begun to investigate, and there's a question about whether it will go forward now, right?
Well, I think the good news is that the staff began the investigation before the change, and they'll continue it. And I think if this new board tries to crack down or squelch the investigation, you know, people will be screaming, including me and you and everybody else, I would think, I hope. The staff leader of the investigation is now the actual executive director, or will be the middle of this month, Kim Strack. She's a crackerjack investigator, so to have her at the leadership of the agency, I think, is a good sign. We are going to be watching closely. We'll be providing new information. Some of the other media folks, the Associated Press, is doing a good job of digging, so we need.
We also raise a good question, so we'll definitely keep our eyes on this particular investigation as it involves politics. But it does raise the question of what influence money has on any endeavor when you know you're beholden to the person who signed the check. So maybe to grasp how money influences public policy, we ought to see how it works in, for instance, science. Researchers have to go to potential donors. They have to ask for money. And does that process affect the kind of work that gets done? Joining us now are Niko Kasanets. Kasanets is a professor in the Department of Cell Biology at Duke University's Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. And Lindsay Zano is director of Paleontology Research Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, also teaches biology at North Carolina State. Niko and Lindsay, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Good to be back.
Niko, I know you track national politics closely, but you're a researcher. You have to go to people for money to do your research. How does that work, and what sort of firewalls do you feel you need to place between you and the funders, and what effect does it have on you?
The fact is that the primary source of funding for biomedical research is and remains to be the National Institute of Health. Their budget is over $30 billion a year. And the experience is that since the budget doubling finished in about 2004, we have a net reduction of about 20% in real purchasing power of the NIH, and that is pre-sequester. So we have a very large gap to fill, and it is not clear to any of us how this gap will be filled. So it's a complicated issue because on one part, the population expects results from dollars that were placed into the federal budget to give out to the research organization on a competitive basis. And I would say that the system there is actually quite merit-driven. However, now it's very difficult to be merit-driven because the success rates are so low, it becomes stochastic. So on one hand, the population has a very need for pretty close gratification. Where did my money go? And unfortunately, research doesn't quite work that way. It's not like, you know, give me $20 million, I'll give you a drug for Alzheimer's disease.
I was going to say, when you say the results are low, you're saying it takes a long time to get to.
It takes a very long time to get to. And something that is unique about the science, and I think we as scientists might have done a very poor job at explaining, is that the biggest outcomes out of science is when serendipity is allowed to happen. Some of the biggest determinants of orthogonal scientific process were not driven because either a corporation or a federal government contributed finances. Penicillin was not discovered because there was a grant to discover penicillin. And yet I could argue that this has saved more lives than anything else that we can say. It is true at the same time that the discovery of new therapeutic has not tracked the investment. But there's other reasons about this, including the fact that science and medicine have become far more complex, and the regulatory burden over these things has likewise become very complex. So where are we now? We have to move into a system where somebody else has to pick up the deficit left behind by the NIH. Foundations are doing this to a degree, but we can imagine that this is billions of dollars that we're talking about, and it's a very difficult bucket to fill.
So, Lindsay, how do you do this? There's been a decrease in funding, we know, for research and science across the board. You must have felt it. Have you thought about what to do, to how you're going to make this up?
Well, I think one of the important things to recognize is that in any system like this, the number of different models you can have for fundraising is going to sort of dampen all of those negative effects that we're talking about. So there's a movement underway with scientists to sort of reach out more directly and filter out these bureaucratic layers involved in funding sources and go directly to the public, something we call crowdsourcing or crowdfunding. And not just financially, but also in terms of contributing volunteerism to scientific projects. So citizen science is another model that works really well to sort of fill this gap. But you have to remember that those are on the scale that is very minor compared to the magnitude of the sort of funding that we're used to receiving at the federal level.
Yeah, and you can see the advantage of that. If I hear about a great little cafe that's going up in Durham and they do a Kickstarter and I say, man, Durham could use that. Here's my $100. Go at it. I'm engaged and I'm probably going to show up at that place. They're going to have a mug with my name on it. And now I really care about that place in the same way that that kind of thing could engage me in science because I gave my $100 to your paleontology research. And so now I care a little bit more. But you say the problem is the gap. I can't give you $1 billion.
Well, I think it's interesting because in a way the social media revolution has kind of changed the landscape of how this can work, whereas in the past someone might have thought there's no way I can contribute enough to have an impact on a scientific research program. The collective action has proven again and again recently that one small individual in the sort of social media realm that we're working within can have a huge impact because of the snowballing effect of that. So some of the research that I do in particular can actually be run on very small amounts of money, say $10,000 to fund an entire research program for the summer. So one individual giving a dollar and you get the snowball effect of, say, 10,000 individuals joining in, and they can actually have a really meaningful and significant effect on that. But you're right, it does have sort of the side effect of drawing people in and getting them connected in science, which is something that we as scientists it's become a major goal for what we want to do in the future going forward.
But my other question around all of this is influence. When you go to those major donors who have their own agenda or agendas, I mean, NIH may be a, sort of a broad funding source, but the National Cancer Institute or others that have more specific and targeted goals, does that in any way restrict the kind of research you can do because they're signing the check? And I'll start with you, Nico.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yes and no. It depends who it is. So the big national institutes, they have a part portfolio dedicated to very specific programs. So we've heard about the Brain Map Initiative recently, or we have the new Translational Institute at the NIH. These are not bad things because you do need focused things. Like we couldn't have crowdsourced the Human Genome Project. We needed to have a dedicated pot of money for the Human Genome Project, and it's ours. So that's fine. The problem becomes when you go to philanthropy, which is becoming an increasing driver, and most universities are recognizing it as an ever-increasing driver need. And there you will find two flavors. And I'm not belittling either, but it's a fact of life. One flavor will say people like the recent Bloomberg donation to Hopkins, $300 million, to generate a very large number of chairs with people to have discretionary funding to exercise their creativity and their synergy because it has to be multidepartmental. That's a terrific model. And I know that Bloomberg does not really expect something specific out of this. On the other hand, you have the other flavor of a donor who is highly sensitized by very narrow focus. So I have had some individuals, some of them are grateful patients, who will say, I will want to give you or your institution or your team a sometimes significant amount of money, but you will have to research gout. And you might say, well, I don't really want to research gout, but this is where the money is. So you might find yourself being driven by where the resources are as opposed to where your natural interest is. Now, again, I would say this is good and bad. In some cases, it's good to have your eye on the ball. But in many cases, it reduces the opportunity for serendipity, and this is what I'm worried about the most.
Bob Hall, as you listen to this discussion about the way science research is funded and some speculation about the way it may be in the future, how does that relate back to lobbyists? Because on the one hand, we want to be able to collect. So if I have a cause and an interest, I'd like to get some folks together, pay somebody to work full-time on Capitol Hill to get that legislation through and educate and inform those lawmakers, because I and my friends who collected this money believe it's important. That's how we want to use our money as lobbyists. What's wrong with that?
Well, that as long as it's a public elections are all a public process. Your participation is public. It's all guaranteed by our Constitution, petitioning your government, bringing forward your ideas, and so on. If you pay the lobbyists to bring information to the congressman or legislator, that's a great help explain them. They got 1,000 different bills to figure out, so they need people to help them figure out what the priorities are and understand the devil in the details. But when the lobbyist is carrying a check with them or saying, if you don't do this, we're going to invest $500,000 to beat you, then the whole equation changes. Because that legislator doesn't have another option. They don't have they know it's a private-funded system. And they're really very fearful now under the Citizens United. The atmosphere we have now is where a couple donors can come in using corporate money and just blanket, right, take out somebody.
National and international corporations can target state elections, which they're doing.
Right.
And
they did in North Carolina.
Just blow you up. And the other thing is transparency. If we get back to the sweepstakes gambling, if I don't know where the money came from and I as a voter don't know who funded and who was behind that candidate, then really, NIH, we know what NIH is, National Cancer Institute. And even if it's, Ethel for the elimination of gout, we get what that person was up to.
Yeah.
Without the transparency, it seems to me that's what's missing in this kind of
fight. Well, it's both the transparency. I mean, it's good to have an X-ray, to be able to see what the disease is and where the money's coming from. But knowing that it's donor A instead of donor B, what you really want is a whole nother source of funding. You want the public, the NIH equivalent for the public process of elections. We don't have that. The undergirding of the scientific research is a public – there's a recognized public purpose in it. The whole election system is a public purpose, but yet we haven't given it the underlying public source of money, which would be this kind of public financing system where, and again, you have the crowdsourcing. If you get people to invest by giving $20, $50 donations, that gives a candidate access to the bigger money. Then that $20, $30 donor, they feel invested. They get involved in the campaign. They get their neighbors to say, hey, this is a good, and they'll get involved in the campaign.
I just wanted to say that it's interesting because the lack of transparency sometimes in the scientific process is actually triggered more to greater benefit. The people who want to remain anonymous and the people who want to not be known what they're funding are the people who permit the scientific enterprise greater leeways. It's essentially saying, here's a chunk of money. I don't want to be identified with this. Do something cool.
Right.
Help humankind, which is diametrically opposed to what is going on. So it's an interesting point.
But Lindsay, let me ask you, and very briefly, if there's a decrease in the amount of public funding that goes into organizations like NIH that say, go ahead, spend it, come up with what you do, is there a chance that it's going to be filled partly with crowdsourcing, but also with more pointed kinds of organizations, private research or private firms that are going to direct and perhaps limit the scope of scientific research to fill in that gap? Is that a concern?
It's a serious concern. I mean, let's not forget what science is. It's fundamentally a creative process. Scientists are people who use creativity to address problems. Without that sort of a liberty to investigate the problems that we see arising on the day-to-day basis, you're sort of stifling and channeling science into directions. The problem is we sort of assume that we can view what those directions are going to be in the future now. And by channeling them in now, we're sort of limiting the direction of possibilities we can go in the future. And what are the odds that we're really being able to identify what those things are going to be?
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Lindsay Zano is director of the Paleontology Research Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and teaches biology at NC State. Nico Katsanis is a professor in the Department of Cell Biology at Duke's Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, and Bob Hall, director of Democracy North Carolina. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Coming up, Phil Cook and the Guitar Heels celebrate Rye Cooter. Stay tuned.